John and I did together, and plus another one. On the surface, they may look like they're related if you have read the abstract, but actually, I will argue that they are closely related because they all fit into the overall framework of simulation, and they're all about geography and spatial patterns, especially street network. And so I will hopefully, by using the examples, I can make some sense out of these projects and be able to link those to what we are trying to discuss here. Well, look at my education background. I have been everywhere. So, geomorphology, that's where I got my bachelor's degree, and remote sensing mapping, that's my master's degree. And then GIS, economic geography, that's my PhD. And since then, I learned a little bit about computer science. And of course, John taught me criminology, and I was joking to him over lunch, saying that a friend of mine once told me there's no such thing as incapable students. They are only incapable professors. any students in this room? I don't know who I am by John's definition, so he has to tell me on that. And the way I got into this was about 6 years ago. There was a faculty development grant that we got, and through the project, I got to know John and found out that we share common interests. So since then, we have been working together, and we ask each other tough questions, and he would say I'm wrong, and sometimes I would tell him he's wrong. So this collaboration has actually been leading to some external funding. A little bit of motivation. Actually, this happened 2 weeks ago. I have a MA student who has a criminology bachelor's degree. So he came to me in searching for a thesis topic. He read something about aggressive policing. And there were, there have been some studies testing this hypothesis that if you are more aggressive on minor offenses, then you tend to reduce the overall serious crime. Sounds reasonable, and actually previous studies suggested that was indeed the case. But these studies were conducted at the city level, so they used city as the unit of analysis. So my student was trying to borrow that model and apply it to the neighborhoods in Cincinnati. And he was rather surprised when he ran the correlation between the two variables. The correlation is positive and very strong, like 0.9 something. So he was surprised. I thought about it, although I don't know the answer, but I think the geographical scale has something to do with it. And when you change the geographic scale, you may need to re-specify the model. In this case, since at a city neighborhood area, like high crime area, you would see high rate of arrest on my offense anyway. Plus, you will have a high rate of serious crime rate. Of course, the two are positively correlated. Perhaps the hypothesis, we should change the hypothesis to this. Testing the correlation on the change. Well, that's just the motivation. So this is what I'm going to talk about.
Can I ask a naive question about that? So naively, it would seem to me that an explanation would be that, let's say you're contrasting two different policies. So New York, say, with a broken windows policy, cracking down in some other city that didn't. That's one study, and there you, if you had places with different policies for the city, you might expect then a negative correlation. Whereas if you're taking neighborhoods in a city, some of them have a lot of crime and some of them don't. And that positive correlation would just reflect the fact that there's a lot of crime there, independent of what policy the city has, which is the same presumably across the city.
I think that's precisely the point. Citywide is a closed system. Versus at the neighborhood level, you don't have a closed system. So you have interaction with other neighborhoods. So fundamentally, you will have to change the model. That's my take, and I agree with your comment on that. Thanks. So I'll talk about a racial profile project that John and I did a while ago, and then some simulation-related work to study point pattern and error pattern, and to see how by considering the spatial infrastructure, we can actually improve the accuracy of the model. And then I will move on to what I really want to talk about, the simulation. And okay, I will try to rush through the first two issues here. I put a quotation mark on racial profiling because I really don't know much about it. And what I know is this hypothesis, basically the minorities being stopped by police more often in a disproportionate way. And also, to a geographer like myself, we always try to distinguish between process and pattern. So even if you notice a certain pattern, you don't know the process behind it. So we have an article on this, forthcoming. So if we look at the police vehicle stops, this is the city of Cincinnati. Downtown is right here. The red lines are the interstate highways. And the southern border is Ohio River. Okay, so as you can see, the darker area reflect a higher density of vehicle stops, and this is how density is calculated. So the number of stops per square mile. So that's the overall pattern. But if you break them down by race and by time, so we have daytime on the top, black versus, let's see. We have daytime here, daytime. So the left is the stop distribution during the day, and on the right you have the stop distribution overnight. And as you can see, they are different patterns. I mean, the patterns are different. The explanation to that is during the day, a lot of stops are related to commuting folks. And at night, the stops tend to concentrate on where people live. So the question is, are the minorities indeed being stopped more often in proportion to their population base? And so this typically we use what is called a disproportionality index. It's a ratio of ratio. So basically, these two are exactly the same actually. So if you look at the proportion of the stops over the expected proportion, so if you focus on the, so this is black drivers being stopped over the total stops, and then this is the baseline measure. Baseline for black population versus the total baseline. And if the index is one, then there's no disproportionality. So the real issue is how you calculate the DI. And the numerator is easy. You get the number of stops from the contact record. So assuming those data are indeed correct, so that is a relatively straightforward process. The denominator, on the other hand, is very difficult to calculate. If you use the census population, then you assume people drive where they live, which is not right. And so how do you improve that? Well, we argue that not only the census population data is not reasonable, and you can't even use, you shouldn't even use the number of drivers, because consider two drivers, one drives 5 miles a day, the other drives 30 miles a day. The second person has a high exposure rate to potential police stop. So what we try to estimate is the what we call vehicle miles by race, each of the 52 neighborhood areas. I'm not going to get into details of the calculation, but we used daily counts, we used the trip table, like the from each transportation analysis zone to another, how many people commute to work. And from there, plus field observation, we figured out during the rush hours what's the overall vehicle miles and what portion of that are contributed by black drivers. And then we have a portion of that during the work hours and then nighttime. And we have detailed the description of the process in the paper. And so we have two maps comparing the driving population versus vehicle miles. And you can clearly see that these spatial patterns of between these two sets of maps are quite different. So therefore, since we are going to use these as the denominators, and you would expect a big difference on the calculate on the result of the DR index. And this is what we came up with. So on the top, we have the DI based on driving population. And if you look at the range of the index value at the neighborhood level, you have a 0 to 17.88, which is very high. And in the overall city, you have 1.23. And then if you change that, the denominator to vehicle miles, for the 52, at the neighborhood area level, the maximum is reduced to 3.24. But for the entire city, it actually went up, which is expected because the minority people tend to have less mobility. And so that's why this overall index went up. So what does that, what do the numbers tell you? And I think looking at the absolute numbers or the numbers for the entire city may be useful, but I think if you're looking into ways where you can improve on the situation, then you really have to look at this spatial distribution. This map shows the DI index based on driving population, which is the way you should not use. But for the purpose of comparison, I have it here anyway. So the way it is classified is, I look at the entire range and use one as the middle point, and then I go to each side about, let's see, 2.5% to each side, so I create this natural neutral class, which counts for 5% of the overall range. And as you can see, the majority of the area seems there's no problem. And in the blue area, the white drivers are stopped more often, and the red areas or purple areas are the one are where minority drivers stop more often. But once you change that, change the denominator to vehicle miles, the overall picture changed quite a bit. Even though the difference has decreased, but for most of the areas, especially the north central part of the area, you see red or purple, which means minorities are stopped more often. And so what we can learn from here, again, I'm not going to draw any kind of conclusion on the racial profiling issue. And when this project was completed, we didn't know. Let me flip back. And this number here, 1.23. We didn't know what this number would be for different cities. Later on, we found out for Columbus, this number is actually higher. And Columbus is being labeled as a model city in terms of racial relationship. So again, my point is this number alone, this single number tells the big picture. So now, how is this related to simulation? I haven't done simulation in this context, but I think this is one of the problems simulation will actually be able to help. Because the traditional approach, at least I talked to many different people and checked into the literature, they don't seem to be a solution to this. What we really need is you need to find out at each street segment the number of vehicle miles driven by the white population and the African Americans. And there's just no way to be able to come up with an accurate measure. So simulation may be able to help. Okay. The second project I want to briefly describe is where we all know the modifiable area unit problem. Basically says depending on how the unit of analysis is aggregated, your result will vary, sometimes very significantly. And I think this is the project we did is on is a related to epidemiology, basically trying to investigate if the drinking water quality is related to gastrointestinal illness. And of course, what we are dealing here are the pipeline networks. But in my opinion, pipeline networks are very similar to street networks, even though the way it works may be different, because the water in the pipelines are driven by pressure, so it's a pressure-driven system. And you may be able to argue the flow, traffic flow, can be explained in a similar mechanism. I'm not sure. Anyway, so I see a connection to crime analysis. So this is a pipeline network, and there is a software called EPANet, which help generate measurements of water quality through simulation. Okay, so at each node, each dot is a node, you can get a measure of water quality through simulation. And then, now why we're using polygon data here? Because the GI gastrointestinal illness data collected by hospitals, and they are made available at the zip code level. So you have a mismatch there. You have a point distribution, and then you have a polygon distribution. So what we want to do, try to do, is to create ways such that we can consider the scaling effect and the zoning effect. The scaling effect is this direction. Basically, you have the size of the polygons is different, so from small to large. And the zoning, you can create different zones. So we used the first set of the census area units, and the middle one needs no explanation. And the one on the right, those are the Renoir diagrams created from activity nodes. So this is how, so we're going to look at the change in the correlation between these two variables by different ways of aggregation. Now, they are obviously confounding factors, okay? So the correlation between the two shouldn't be one. But for the sake of investigating the bias caused by this mock problem, we started with a theoretical assumption, that is, what would happen if there were perfect correlation between the two. And then what we will do is we create two scenarios. In the first scenario, we have point distributed water quality data. And then the GI data are based on polygon. Then what we will do is randomly assign the GI instances within each polygon. So that's the typical approach we take when we try to match point data with polygon data. And the second scenario, what we did was actually, since we assume there is a correlation between these two variables, why don't we assign the GI points along the pipeline network? So we do this on the control layer. Notice that we have 9 layers. So we select one of them as the control layer, and then do the simulation, create a point distribution, and then use the remaining 8 as aggregation layers, and to see the correlation coefficients for these two scenarios. At the control layer, obviously, the two will be identical. They're perfect, because that's by design. Once you re-aggregate what we hope, or what we expect, is the scenario 2, which is based on network, should be better than the first one. But what we don't know is to what degree. This is the result. And for scenario 1, basically you randomly distribute GI points in polygon. The mean is lower, it's about close to 0.9. And the range is quite large, so from 0.7 all the way up to 0.9 something. However, if we consider the network structure, you notice that not only the mean increased to 9.5 or so, and the range is reduced, so you have less uncertainty. Although we have not applied this simulation to crime data, but I would think that you would end up with similar results. Maybe the actual range and the mean may be different. So, so I have used 2 examples to show, in a way, the spatial network is important. And we had this sort of debate yesterday on whether the real geographic environment should be used in simulation, in crime simulation. And so I thought this actually perfectly related to that discussion, and I will have my opinion at the end of my third part. So we, starting from the year 2000, John, 6 years ago, we started to having this discussion of simulation. And initially, it wasn't agent-based. And then later on, basically trying to get into the flow and started using the agent-based. And so what we try to do is to integrate agent-based modeling and a cellular automaton model to simulate street cooperative events. And I want to emphasize the events here. So this is an event-based model. We are not simulating the overall pattern. Of course, when you accumulate the events in time, you will see pattern being developed. I will get back to the book, John, editing, hopefully it will come out by the end of the year, which is related to crime simulation. A lot of people have talked about routine activity theory, and this is also the basis of our of simulation. And so let me briefly describe sort of the conceptual framework of what we're trying to do here. Imagine this is a street, and I'm wondering, and walking along the street, and everything is fine. Then John joins me, and suppose I'm the target, and he is a potential offender, just for the sake of discussion.
Sounds right.
So we run into the same spot. Maybe the first encounter, nothing happened, and then we were running into each other again. He attempted to really take some cash out from me. At this point, so a crime event is generated. So what we decided to model this is that whenever a crime is a crime event occurs, there is this fear or tension, which so at this at the exact crime event location, so you will have suddenly have this fear. Now this fear propagates in space and time. It's like a wave system. Okay? Now if there are multiple crime events on this street, you will see another wave propagation function. And so along the street, you would what we call, then we will have an array in one dimension, which is array of tension, and which changes in space and time, and following the wave function described in previous presentations, similar, and that will adjust the behavior of agents. So offenders learn from it, target victims also learn from it. Now, expand that into two-dimensional space. And if you assign or schedule routine activities for target agent, then they will walk along the streets. If nothing happens, then obviously you take the shortest path. But in the presence of a crime event, which create a tension surface now the tension surface is a two-dimensional surface, and the targets and the offenders will both learn from the tension surface and adjust their behavior. So at this point, spatial navigation of target agent is not a shortest path problem. So each target will learn from the environment. So the path finding suddenly becomes a local optimization issue. What we used then is a reinforcement learning algorithm. And so that's the way, the thought process. Now let's look at the model. So we have the input of the agents and the properties and the methods of the agents, and then we have the environment. And I'll get back to this, whether we should use the real geographic environment or a virtual environment would do just as well. And then the simulation component itself, again, is an agent-based model plus a CA model. And it is a dynamic model. It is also a stochastic model, meaning more deterministic, and is adaptive. So the agents learn from the experience, change their property. For example, once I get robbed once, I learn to be smarter next time, don't carry as much cash, or I walk with other people, and things like that. And also, the adaptation is also reflected on the spatial wayfinding. You try to avoid places that are dangerous. Now, what are the outputs? The outputs will be history of individual crime events, and then the accumulation of those events will form patterns which are visible on the display. And we have the activities and the behavior of all the agents saved, which you can go back to analyze. And actually, it is also possible to save the spatial-temporal propagation of retention, which I don't think we have that at this point, but I think that may be something worthwhile to look at. So, okay, so I've mentioned some of this already. So we have a CA model, and we use local rules to define the propagation of tension and some other variables. And in time, these local rules will have an impact at the global level. And that's, I think that's the essence of all the simulation. And then we place agents on this CA, on the CA. CA basically has a great structure, and some of the cells are on the streets, others are not. And in our system, agents will only move along streets. Okay, let's look at. I talked about the state variable. Tension is something that we made up. And we call it tension, or you can call it fear. So it's sort of a surrogate measure of people's reaction to crime. It can be global, it can be local. And if we use the analogy of the news media or personal experience, and so any individual crime event would increase the tension at that crime location, and then that decays in space and time. The way to visualize this is like you throw stones to a pond, and then each stone creates a water wave, and then multiple crime events will generate multiple tension waves, and they tend to mix, and that's what the tension surface should look like. In our model. Unfortunately, I don't have a map to show that. So we have four types of agents, and actually the fourth one has not been implemented. So you have offender, target, and the place manager. And each type, this is based on John's triangle, routine activity triangle. And so each type of agents has properties and methods. Again, these are in accordance to John's framework. And what we can do is to set different adaptation rates. So they are fast learners, they are slow learners, and then in our experiment, we can set different adaptation rates to different groups of agents, and see how that affect their behavior and how that changes the spatial pattern of a crime. And we also allow scheduling of activities, so you can specify an activity node in the network. And so an example of that is you can travel from home to shopping back to home. And suppose if there are multiple shopping locations you can choose from, which way to go is affected by this learning process. Okay. So target, so each time a target get robbed, there will be a cost, okay? The cost will be decay in time. And the target has a cognitive map. A spatial cognitive map, and which has two components. One is the spatial proximity, and the other one is the cost map. So these two combined gas will help determine the spatial movement of the target. Target movement is determined by spatial proximity and the cost, which, again, I said earlier, it is a local model. And so you learn once you get there. And the algorithm used is a typical reinforcement learning algorithm that you can find from a machine learning textbook. Similarly, offender has so each event there will be a reward to offender, and then offenders have their own cognitive map as well. And the cognitive map will guide the spatial movement of offender agents. Okay. So we implemented this, and so on those, you can have multiple panels. You can have a panel showing the spatial cluster of crime events or the accumulation of individual crime events. And the other panel can actually show the real-time movement of agents. What I want to show you instead is this panel. It has lots of coefficients, and I guess about 15 here, and actually there are a few more that's not displayed in this window. And this is important. So you're talking about 20-some parameters here in this model. And this goes back to, now the question asked, one of the questions asked in Hank's presentation is, well, he was arguing that you don't need a real geographical environment in simulation. And there were other presentations that talked about prediction. So a natural question is, if you don't have real geographical environment, how can you predict? Right? Sounds reasonable. Okay, hold on to the question. I'll get back, and I have hopefully I'll be able to explain. So what is this? Is this simulation? What can this simulation do? I make it clear: this cannot be used for prediction. There are too many parameters. There's no way you can calibrate it. So instead, what we can do is we can examine the process, the processes, and then we can examine how different theories interplay, and then we can also explore different scenarios and hopefully be able to generate some hypotheses. And since we saved the history of the behavior and actions of individual agents, we could go back to the data and to analyze simulated data. And so those are the things we can do. And we actually tried a few different experiments, changing the adaptation rate to see how that changed the spatial movement, and see how that may affect the distribution of the crime events. And this is not a surprise. So all along we have heard this so many times, and this is something our simulation package you can generate as well. Now back to that book that John and I are editing on crime simulation. One of the things we have thought about is how do we put different simulation systems into an overall sort of a framework so that we can say something about them. And we don't have a sort of a typology. And some of the confusions or some of the questions I think can be explained with the assistance of something like this. So I listed six criteria here. The first one, whether this is spatial or aspatial. So if you treat a city as a whole, as a one unit, I don't regard that as a spatial. Okay. Or even if your unit of analysis is the neighborhood areas in the city, but you don't address the spatial interaction between the neighboring units, that is not a spatial model either. So we have aspatial and spatial. And the second criteria is data-driven or theory-driven. I think this point is important. The theory-driven model, you would have use existing theories to specify functions on the properties and the methods of each agent. So that's what created so many parameters in the theory-driven model. So there are inherent problems with this kind of model. If you have theory-driven model, you have too many parameters, then naturally they are hard to calibrate. Data-driven model, on the other hand, you cannot say much about the process, but that can be an advantage if your goal is for prediction. Continuous versus discrete, and we have seen lots of differential equations in the past 5 days. I think those are the examples of a continuous simulation. And discrete simulation, most of the agent-based simulation work presented during this week, I think, belong to this Excel-based or network, graph theory-based. I can argue that that's also discrete as well. And next one is whether the agents can move, and they move in an intelligent way rather than random walking. So we have stationary and the mobile. And the next one is the geographic environment, artificial and real. And finally, whether the model is deterministic or probabilistic. So with a deterministic model, every time you will generate the exact same result. I'm not quite convinced that all the links are meaningful. So that's why I put a few question marks here and there. And this is where we would like to have your feedback. So now, for a given simulation model, you can use a 6-digit code. So for example, our model, the spaces model, is represented by a purple line. Actually, this can go either way, because some of the data we used is real, some of the data we used is not. So the geographic environment used in our model is sort of a combination of real and artificial. So that's why I put an X there. And if something doesn't apply, you can use a 0. For example, if you did not use the agent-based modeling, then you put 0 in the digital number 4 if you count from left to right. And you can also expand the definition. For example, if you, on number 3, if you use a hybrid model, or actually on number 2, if you use hybrid model, which is sort of a mixture of data-driven and theory-driven, you can use, again, expand the definition as well. A few key issues. Try to finish in 2 minutes. Calibration and the validation. Again, the type of models, whether you can calibrate or not, are inherently related to the nature of the model. Now, the theory-driven models are hard to calibrate. There's just too many parameters. Okay, we don't have the data, or the data we have are not good. But I am aware of some research on the simulation of land use change and the ecology side, where people actually use survey data to calibrate the parameters of their agents. Data-driven models, then those are easy, tend to be easier to calibrate. But when you do calibrate for prediction, you must, of course, use real geographic environment. Now, when you calibrate spatial simulation model, I think a key issue is how do you compare the spatial layers. So you have a layer of a real crime event, and you have a layer of simulated crime event. And how do you measure the similarity between the two layers? Now, is a global measure good enough? I have seen research on again on the land use change. They use all kinds of measures. They use, for example, the global marine eye as a comparison, which I argue is not a reasonable measure. And the other ones we run correlation, cell-based correlation, and that is not good either. So this is a critical issue, and I believe that we can come up with solutions, but right now I don't think that we have a good one. The issue of prediction I have mentioned here and there. For a spatial model, this may be possible to a certain degree. Presentation by Burke is an example of that. We also know individual events is impossible to predict. I'm talking about the exact time and the location, so we can forget that. This is where what can be interesting. So can you find that? So the issue is, can you define a temporal interval that would generate a pattern that is plausible? And so you should define that interval as small as possible to make it meaningful and be able to intervene. And I assume that interval will vary by crime, so just by intuition. So if crime events are more frequent, then you don't need as much time. So I think that this may be the should be the focus. Most of the agent-based crime event simulation models that we have been doing. Well, this is no brainer too. But I think the point below is more important. So if you have a calibrated model, use the newest care, because we all know, even if you have it calibrated, it is only one of the many, many, many possible scenarios that will also lead you to the same pattern. So this is sort of the summary statement, and the theory-based, like spaces, I would use as a virtual lab to start the process, but I would not use it for prediction. And if you want to do it for prediction, like the second criteria is one, use data-driven model, which was the one we included in the second vision for prediction, but not for making a causal statement. I think the challenge, I see two things we should do. One is, let me go the second point here. I think we have implemented, we have come up with a few successful implementations of a theory-driven model. And the focus, I think, should be switched to the design of experiments, sound experiments, that will help us to, or lead us to new findings. And this is something I think we need to do a lot more. Usually we stop at the model can be used for this and that, and examples are not really strong. And the point number one here, I think it is very challenging, and so we come up with a model that we can make causal statements and be able to predict. The day we can come up with this is the day police department could use it, but I don't know how far away that is.